Chapter 19. Confessions of a Tortured Man. Several days later, Yamin drove me out of Tehran, through a dusty and impoverished shantytown, along an old camel trail, and out to the edge of the desert. With the sun setting behind the city, he stopped his car at a cluster of tiny mud shacks, surrounded by palm trees. "A very old oasis," he explained, "dating back centuries before Marco Polo." He preceded me to one of the shacks. "The man inside has a PhD from one of your most prestigious universities. For reasons that will soon be clear, he must remain nameless. You can call him Doc." He knocked on the wooden door, and there was a muffled response. Yamin pushed the door open and led me inside. The tiny room was windowless and lit only by an oil lamp on a low table in one corner. As my eyes adjusted, I saw that the dirt floor was covered with Persian carpets. Then the shadowy outline of a man began to emerge. He was seated in front of the lamp in a way that kept his features hidden. I could tell only that he was bundled in blankets and was wearing something around his head. He sat in a wheelchair, and other than the table, this was the only piece of furniture in the room. Yamin motioned for me to sit on a carpet. He went up and gently embraced the man, speaking a few words in his ear, then returned and sat at my side. "I've told you about Mr. Perkins," he said. "We're both honored to have this opportunity to visit with you, sir."
"Mr. Perkins, you are welcome."
The voice, with barely any detectable accent, was low and hoarse. I found myself leaning forward into the small space between us as he said,
"You see before you a broken man. I have not always been so. Once I was strong like you. I was a close and trusted advisor to the Shah."
There was a long pause.
"The Shah of Shahs, King of Kings."
His tone of voice sounded, I thought, more sad than angry.
"I personally knew many of the world's leaders, Eisenhower, Nixon, de Gaulle. They trusted me to help lead this country into the capitalist camp. The Shah trusted me and,"
he made a sound that could have been a cough, but which I took for a laugh,
"I trusted the Shah. I believed his rhetoric. I was convinced that Iran would lead the Muslim world into a new epoch, that Persia would fulfill its promise. It seemed our destiny, the Shah's, mine, all of ours, who carried out the mission we thought we had been born to fulfill."
The lump of blankets moved. The wheelchair made a wheezing noise and turned slightly. I could see the outline of the man's face in profile, his shaggy beard, and then it grabbed me. The flatness. He had no nose. I shuddered and stifled a gasp.
"Not a pretty sight, would you say, ah, Mr. Perkins? Too bad you can't see it in full light. It is truly grotesque."
Again there was the sound of choking laughter.
"But, as I'm sure you can appreciate, I must remain anonymous. Certainly you could learn my identity if you tried, although you might find that I am dead. Officially, I no longer exist. Yet, I trust you won't try. You and your family are better off not knowing who I am. The arm of the Shah and Savak reaches far."
The chair wheezed and returned to its original position. I felt a sense of relief, as though not seeing the profile somehow obliterated the violence that had been done. At the time, I did not know of this custom among some Islamic cultures. Individuals deemed to have brought dishonor or disgrace upon society or its leaders are punished by having their noses cut off. In this way, they are marked for life, as this man's face clearly demonstrated.
"I'm sure, Mr. Perkins, you're wondering why we invited you here."
Without waiting for my response, the man in the wheelchair continued,
"You see, this man who calls himself the King of Kings is in reality satanic. His father was deposed by your CIA with, I hate to say it, my help, because he was said to be a Nazi collaborator. And then there was the Mossadegh calamity. Today, our Shah is on the route to surpassing Hitler in the realms of evil. He does this with the full knowledge and support of your government." "Why is that?" I asked. "Quite simple. He is your only real ally in the Middle East, and the industrial world rotates on the axle of oil that is the Middle East. Oh, you have Israel, of course, but that's actually a liability to you, not an asset. And no oil there. Your politicians must placate the Jewish vote, must get their money to finance campaigns. So you're stuck with Israel, I'm afraid. However, Iran is the key. Your oil companies, which carry even more power than the Jews, need us. You need our Shah, or you think you do, just as you thought you needed South Vietnam's corrupt leaders." "Are you suggesting otherwise? Is Iran the equivalent to Vietnam?" "Potentially much worse. You see, this Shah won't last much longer. The Muslim world hates him, not just the Arabs, but Muslims everywhere, Indonesia, the United States, but mostly right here, his own Persian people." There was a thumping sound, and I realized that he had struck the side of his chair. "He is evil. We Persians hate him." Then silence. I could hear only his heavy breathing, as though the exertion had exhausted him. "Doc is very close to the mullahs," Yamin said to me, his voice low and calm. "There is a huge undercurrent among the religious factions here, and it pervades most of our country, except for a handful of people in the commercial classes who benefit from the Shah's capitalism." "I don't doubt you," I said, "but I must say that during 4 visits here, I've seen nothing of it. Everyone I talk with seems to love the Shah, to appreciate the economic upsurge." "You don't speak Farsi," Yamin observed. "You hear only what is told to you by those men who benefit the most. The ones who have been educated in the States or in England end up working for the Shah. Doc here is an exception, now." He paused, seeming to ponder his next words. "It's the same with your press. They only talk with the few who are his kin, his circle. Of course, for the most part, your press is also controlled by oil, so they hear what they want to hear and write what their advertisers want to read." "Why are we telling you all this, Mr. Perkins?" Doc's voice was even more hoarse than before, as if the effort of speaking and the emotions were draining what little energy the man had mustered for this meeting. "Because we'd like to convince you to get out, and to persuade your company to stay away from our country. We want to warn you that although you may think you'll make a great deal of money here, it's an illusion. This government will not last." Again, I heard the sound of his hand thudding against the chair. "And when it goes, the one that replaces it will have no sympathy for you and your kind." "You're saying we won't be paid?" Doc broke down in a fit of coughing. Yamin went to him and rubbed his back. When the coughing ended, he spoke to Doc in Farsi and then came back to his seat. "We must end this conversation," Yamin said to me. "In answer to your question, yes, you will not be paid. You'll do all that work, and when it comes time to collect your fees, the Shah will be gone." During the drive back, I asked Yamin why he and Doc wanted to spare Maine the financial disaster he had predicted. "We'd be happy to see your company go bankrupt. However, we'd rather see you leave Iran. Just one company like yours, walking away, could start a trend. That's what we're hoping. You see, we don't want a bloodbath here, but the Shah must go, and we'll try anything that will make that easier. So we pray to Allah that you'll convince your Mr. Zambadi to get out while there is still time." "Why me?" "I knew during our dinner together, when we spoke of the Flowering Desert Project, that you were open to the truth. I knew that our information about you was correct. You are a man between two worlds, a man in the middle.